As always, let's go there.
Yeah. Bring it to me.
Thank you. Fabulous. All right, Proverbs 25:14. Somebody read that when you get there. 25:14. Please. All right, like clouds without rain. Is there anything more frustrating in the season of a drought when you see clouds rolling in and they look dark and you think they're going to bring rain and they just don't, right? It's maddening to watch the forecast and see that. This is likened to the same idea of a man or a person who boasts of his gifts falsely. What does it mean? In context, as we talked about before with gifts in the Old Testament, we're not talking about spiritual gifts. What gifts are we talking about? Not sacrifices. What was your gift? We talked about this in even the context of Proverbs before. Hi. Poor Bree. What does that mean? What are your gifts? A gift was something, since you guys don't remember, you've got Leviticus on your brain trying to wake up, or Star Wars, one of the two, was what you gave as a younger person to an older person. It was your first impression, right? It was what opened the door for you. The gift opens the door for the giver. In the Old Testament, that's the context. So when you as a younger or lesser than sat in the presence of an older or more than, you would bring them a gift in order to show respect and reverence. So in this context, what does that mean? Like clouds without rain, is he a man who boasts of his gifts falsely? Are we all here this morning? I know break's coming. You guys got a rally. Yes, Jacob. Thank you. I see a hand. Yeah, you're communicating something that you say you are, but in reality, you're not. I'm going to do these things for you. I'll offer you these services, or you're banking your character on these things. And then what happens? When push comes to shove, you don't deliver. You're not authentic. You're a fake. You're a phony. It's like clouds without rain. It is disappointing, okay? As you guys think through your lives, this is not obviously a quality that any of us want to display. We want to be men and women of our word. If we say we're going to do something, we do it. And if we talk about the things that we have to offer to other people, whatever realm they are in, that we do them faithfully, and we don't boast falsely or arrogantly of our gifts. All right, that's the idea. In this context, it's likened to clouds without rain, and we all know what that feels like. Putting on a show. Huh. That's good. I remember going to my first job in a suit and tie at Skaggs Alpha Beta to be a grocery sacker. The guy looked at me, he's like, I think you're a little overdressed. You know, I was like 14. I was just trying to really make a good impression. And my mom dropped me off. And, you know, mom, can you tie my tie for me? You know, suit and tie. Yeah. You know, so it's Oscar's a good word, so. Yeah, been there, done that. So just remember that. Your word goes a long way. And when you back up what you say with what you do, boy, you earn a lot of street cred, and your view is heightened in other people's eyes. And it doesn't take but a couple times to say you're going to commit to something and you drop the ball and don't do it or boast falsely of what you can do, boy, before people lose trust in you quickly. All right? So let that not be said of any of us. All right? Back to Joshua, shall we? So we are in the midst of the conquering of the land. We saw, obviously, yesterday 1 through 5, the conquering prequel, if you will, the preparation to conquer. We saw God's crazy plan of preparing his people, no military strategy given, obey, trust me, and I will go before you. We saw them cross the Jordan River miraculously underneath the hand of Joshua. We saw them move across, and then God in chapter 5 does the insane and says, okay, now that we're all ready to go into battle, we're on the footsteps of Jericho, what are all the men going to do? Brilliant. Brilliant battle plan, God, but that's how God does it. Like, no wonder this doesn't make sense. I'm in Judges. This is not right. Who's Deborah? We haven't even studied her. Like, oh. Got it. So, 5. Perfect. Good. We're all on the same page now. So, God commands the Israelite men to get circumcised, remember, a second time. That had to be fun. But the generation that had not yet been circumcised is now being called to obedience. They get circumcised. Chapter 6, we then see the first battle, right? At what city? Jericho, right? How'd that go?
Pretty well.
Pretty well, right? That was the first of 31 battles against 31 different kings that Israel is going to fight. And then we see the second battle in chapter 7. How did that go? Yeah, defeat, right? What was the name of that city? You guys remember? Ai. Okay, remember that one. And they're going to have to do that one over, and ultimately they do, and God wins the day for them. But boy, it is a bad deal. What happened at Ai that caused the defeat? Yeah, we got sin in the camp, right? Amongst the leadership. We find out Achan's a leader within the realm of Israel, and he coveted what God said don't take, right? In the very next battle, in the ones that proceed after this, God says, man, take from the spoil. Take what you need, but the first one you're going to tithe to me. And what was Joshua's ultimate issue? Why was God frustrated at him?
Disobedience,
but what did Joshua fail to recognize? Yeah, he didn't recognize why they got beat, right? He couldn't figure it out. So as the spiritual leader, as the military leader of the nation, Joshua couldn't put the pieces together and figure out why they had lost. So God kind of gives him an aha moment of telling him, well, this is what happened in chapter 7. Someone has acted unfaithfully, has taken stuff underneath the ban, has broken faith, and you need to deal with it. Okay, so we finished chapter 7. Boy, we saw a hard end of that with Joshua having to ultimately... with the priest, whittle down who it was in Israel that had sinned. We find out it's Achan, and he, his family, and all his possessions end up getting stoned to death in the Valley of Achor, the Valley of Trouble. So that's where we left off yesterday, okay? Now, in chapter 8, we're going to see the do-over, okay? They are 1-1, I guess, right now, if that's safe to say, in battles. And now God's going to send them back into Ai, and they're going to have to redo this battle. Okay, how would you be feeling right now, by the way, if you just came off this battle at Ai and God had you get whooped the first time? A little nervous, right? Like, I wonder how this is going to go. Is God going to show up? Is he going to be faithful like he said he would, or is this going to go poorly? So let's pick up in chapter 8, verse 1, and let's watch now how God originally wanted them to fight this battle. And again, this is fascinating because it's nothing like how they won Jericho.
Said to Joshua, do not be afraid nor dismayed. Take the people of war with you. Rise and go up to Ai. See, I have given into your hand the king of Ai, his people, his city, and his land. And you shall do to Ai and his king as you did to Jericho and his king. Only its spoils and its cattle shall take its booty for yourselves. Lay an ambush for the city behind it.
All right, so we're going to find out that battle plan. It's always weird that they take for booty. It's like, man, it just sounds weird. We're going to find a different term. Sorry, I'm trying to connect my map so that you guys can see. Could not connect to TV card. Why not? Dude, this thing just does not want to play nice with me. Like, we need maps today. You booger. Sorry. Technical difficulties. Shoot. I'm a male. I can't multitask, but you can ask all you want.
How did we decide that, where did we see that Achan was a leader?
It talks about his lineage. Somewhere. Judah Zerai, Zabdi, man by man. It talks about who his pops is as a leader in Israel or something. I forget where it's at now. It describes his dad and his lineage. I'd have to look for it, man. I am sorry. I do not have it on me. My bad. And our TV card is not playing nice. What's that? 7-1, what's it say? Yeah, it describes him. I thought it said more about like his character or his that he was a leader from the tribe of Judah. Yeah. Sorry. All right, well, I'm going to have to describe these fantastic charts to you guys in my head, okay? So get to take the plunder, chapter 8. You're going to ultimately get to take now what's was under the ban is no longer under the ban. Joshua says now in verse 3, arise with all the people to go to war to Ai. And Joshua chose 30,000 men, verse 3, valiant warriors, and sent them out at night. Anybody got a different number in verse 3? This is an ambush. Okay, so they're sending, basically, if you think about a city in your head, it's got tons of like different terrain around it. They're up in the hill country. Joshua is stationing a group of people west of the city to lie in ambush behind like a natural ridge. Okay, 30,000 men in an ambush is a ton. That word men in verse 3 can also mean, or if it's depending on what the Hebrew is, the same Hebrew word that's very close in nature to men also means chiefs. So it looks like that's probably the most accurate. He takes 30 dudes, sticks them behind a mountain chain, and says, stay there, and we're going to ambush the city, okay? You're going to stay behind. In verse 12, he adds 5,000 more people to that ambush that lay in wait behind the city. And we're going to see the strategy with Ai is basically the exact opposite of Jericho. Jericho, they come in, and they're displaying their strength. They're quiet. They march, right? And they're going to show God's strength all at once. Walls fall down, and they win the battle. Okay, not so with Ai, okay? He commanded them in verse 4, stay behind the city. Do not go very far from it, but wait. Okay, wait for my command. And here's the process by which they're going to win this city. Okay, verse 5, he says, I and all the people who are with me will approach the city. It will come about when they first come out to meet us, the men of Ai, we will flee before them. They will come out after us until we have drawn them away from the city. From and then they will say, they are fleeing before us as at first. So we will chase after them. After that, you shall rise from your ambush in verse 7. Take possession of the city of the Lord your God and deliver it into your hand. Verse 8, the men of the ambush are going to come out. They're going to seize the city and they're going to set it on fire. So what's the plan? Do you see what Joshua is doing here? Give me a Cliff Notes version of what we just said.
He's drawing out the army away from the city and having, you know, another part of their army destroy the city.
Perfect. Okay. So they're feigning what? Defeat. Weakness. Okay. So it's weakness that's going to win them the battle, whereas with Jericho, it was what? It was strength. So they're going to fake like they were going to be beaten. They're going to run eastward back towards Gilgal, their home base, and they're going to fake like they were beaten. All the men of the city are going to say, we've got them. Let's pursue them. They're going to come out. As they're fleeing to the east, the men on the west side of the city are going to come out, come into the city, set it on fire. They're going to realize their city's on fire, and where are they stuck between? Literally a rock and a hard place. You've got Joshua's army on one side, the ambush on the other, and you're stuck in between. Okay, so it is this feigning of weakness that ultimately is going to be their strength. So God does things different every time in these battles. So that's Joshua's plan. Verse 12, he sets, again, 5,000 men on the other side of the city. They stationed the people in verse 13 so that all the army was on the north side of the city. This is the normal army that Joshua is going to lead. Okay, verse 15, actually 14, somebody pick up there. And let's watch kind of how this battle unfolds.
Now it happened when the king of Ai saw that the men of the city hurried and rose early and went out against Israel to battle. And he and all his people at the appointed place before the plain. He did not know that there was an ambush against him behind the city. And Joshua and all Israel made as if they were beaten before them and fled by the way of the wilderness.
By the way, what does he play to in verse 14? What quality in this king of Ai is he bringing out? What would lead a guy to leave everything in his city and go chase down Israel?
Arrogance
and pride. Okay, and Joshua knows that. So he's playing up to that pride. So verse 17, not a man was left in Ai or Bethel, which is the neighboring city of Ai, who had not gone out after Israel, and they left the city unguarded and pursued Israel. Dumb, right? But if you think you've got victory in your hand, then you put it in fifth gear and you chase. When Joshua saw what was going on in verse 18, he stretched out his javelin, which was the sign to the men in the ambush to come out. They come out. Verse 19, they arose quickly from their place. He stretched out his hand. They entered the city, captured it, and they quickly set the city on fire. Verse 20, the men of Ai turned back and looked, and behold, the smoke of the city ascended into the sky, and they had no place to flee, this or that. And they said, oh, doo-doo, this was a really bad decision. That's in Hebrew for the... Before they were fleeing in the wilderness, they turned against the pursuers. So Bad day for them. They are now stuck in between Joshua's army, the ambush army. Their city is on fire. It is bad. Verse 22, the others came out from the city, encountered them so that they were trapped in the midst of Israel, some on this side, some on that side. They slew them until there was no one left who had escaped or survived. But the king, they took alive in verse 23 and brought him to Joshua. Okay, so they win that battle that way. Verse 27, we'll pick up in 24. Let's see what happens now in the conclusion of this.
When Israel had finished killing all the inhabitants of Ai in the open wilderness where they pursued them, and all of them to the very last had fallen by the edge of the sword, all Israel returned to Ai and struck it down with the edge of the sword. And all who fell that day, both men and women, were 12,000, all the people of Ai.
Right, so this is a bigger city than Jericho. It's significant in size in terms of the amount of people that are there. And men and women, 12,000 died. Joshua did not withdraw his hand in verse 26 until they destroyed Ai. Verse 27, look here. They took only the cattle and the spoil of that city as plunder for themselves according to the word of the Lord. So they are able to take now, underneath God's command, portions of the bounty of the city, or booty, depending on whatever you want to call it. Purse, booty, like they're all weird names, right? He hanged in verse 29, the king of Ai on a tree till morning. Until evening, and at sunset, not till morning, gave the command that they took his body down from the tree and threw it at the entrance of the city gate, raised it over a great heap of stones that stands to this day. In the book of Deuteronomy, it says that a man cannot be hung overnight. It would be disgraceful. So to hang a king was a sign of victory, but you took his body down before the sunset in order to honor them. Okay, it's part of the disgrace, by the way, of the cross. To hang a man on a tree is a disgraceful act, according to the book of Deuteronomy, and you had to take their body down, and they would not do that with executed criminals as a sign of disgrace. Let me guess what you're going to ask. Go ahead. I got a sneaking suspicion, but go ahead.
So how many of the 31 battles were like that complete destruction?
You know, I don't have an exact count, but we're going to see that's pretty typical. They don't burn the cities normally. Hot sword, they're going to do it. Not hot sword. Ai, they did it. Jericho, they did it. There's a couple other ones they will, but normally they'll leave the cities, and Israel will live in those. Sometimes they will take, in chapter 9, we're going to see an exception to that, where they don't take everybody. They make a covenant under a lie from the Gibeonites and don't do that. But that's a... that is a hard reality of the text that we're in. So it is it is how God deals in this season with the clearing of the land.
So what was the comment you made? I think it was a couple times ago. You said that it wasn't typical of what they did. Jericho was just like, it was a one-time thing.
Yeah, I think that's more to the burning of the city as opposed to how they deal with that. You're going to see them drive people out of the land without necessarily the death toll. So that was an option if the people would submit or surrender, if you will. But if they wouldn't, you're going to see it painted both ways. But this morning, you're going to see a lot of this. And gang, just to be honest, this is not my favorite. Okay, this is the hard reality of warfare. And you look at it and. We're talking about the nature and the character of God, and man, how do you deal with that? How do you reconcile what we know to be a loving God that ultimately one day is going to send His Son to die for these same people, for you and I, that are His enemies, and yet in certain seasons like this one, He's commanding Joshua to execute at times men, women, and children to clear His land so that His people can live there. Okay. We don't see this continued in the stories in terms of this is a constant or a normative action of God, but boy, in this season, it's hard. And I wish I had a great answer for you. I think sometimes we look at this and say, the pushback that I've heard as we talk about seasons like this, where this is how God is moving, is that, oh, there's all these innocent people. And sometimes I think we've got a very jaded view of number one, the people in the land as being innocent, ourselves as being innocent, that God would execute wrath and judgment on us because of our sin. We go, well, in reality, we're not innocent. And you look at the actions of these people and the type of religion that they practice that we've talked about with offering firstborn sons on false altars to false gods. You look at some of the religious actions that they do and how they participate in the religious ceremonies. This is a very morally bankrupt and corrupt people, if you will. Okay. Now, I don't like this any more than you do. I'm not an advocate for it per se, but this is how God chooses to execute his plan. And I look at this in the light of the nature and character of God from a 30,000 foot perspective. Okay, so as you wrestle with this, this is a hard one, okay? So any of you guys got thoughts or commentary on that that can maybe unpack that better, feel free to jump in. But it's a hard reality of where we're at, okay? So, Hawes, anything you'd add to that? Absolutely.
I don't think people want to hear that. They don't want to hear you take away from God's character, but still be gracious in how you explain it.
So, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know that we came up with a great answer, to be honest.
You know what? But that's the tension. That's exactly what I don't want to do for you guys this morning, is somehow explain away what's here. But yet, I don't want to say, yeah, this is normative for God and how he acts and he's angry and bitter or whatever. Like, it's a very weird balance. So you guys can continue to wrestle with that, okay? So that's chapter 8, okay? So they take some of the plunder. They win now Ai, God's way, very different way that they run, that they beat Jericho, if you will. They hang the king. Verse 30 of chapter 8, Joshua builds an altar to the Lord at Mount Ebal. Okay, we blew through this in Deuteronomy, but there's two mountains that are mentioned here. The first one is Mount Ebal in verse 30. All the way down in verse 33, you see half of the group of people stand on Mount Ebal. The other half stand on Mount Gerizim, two mountains in that area where Ai and Bethel is, where they just won this battle. And they, in verse 34, read all the words of the law, the blessing and the curses. You guys remember we talked about in like Deuteronomy, I think it was 28, the blessings and the cursings of the law. Do this and obey, and you're going to get all these awesome things. If you disobey, these are the curses that are going to come. God tells Moses, when you get into the land, stand on Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. One of you is going to holler back to the other group, and you're going to say all the blessings of the law. The other one is going to talk through all the cursings of the law. And Joshua now checks that box of obedience, if you will, after this victory, and they're talking about now the blessings and the cursings of the law. Okay, so they offer in verse 31 burnt offerings and sacrifices as they do that. And Israel stops in verse 33, and they basically worship God and talk through his law. Okay, so you're seeing Joshua, even though he's a military guy, still follow the word of the Lord, still follow the book of the law, and talk through that with in great detail. Okay, so chapter 9, we've got Jericho that's gone down, a walled and fortified city. We've got Ai now that took two battles to go down, but they went down with 12,000 people. If you're the rest of the people of the land, how are you feeling about right now? Scared a little bit, right? The Gibeonites in chapter 9 have a brilliant idea. They understand we're not going to win this battle, right? This is a divine battle. We're going to lose. So we're going to go about this a completely different way. Okay, chapter 9, verse 1. Let's pick up there.
And it came to pass when all the kings who were on this side of the Jordan, in the hills and in the lowlands, and in all the coasts of the great sea toward Lebanon, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite heard about it. They gathered together to fight Joshua and Israel with one accord. But when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard that Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, they worked craftily and went in and pretended to be ambassadors. They took their old sacks of their donkeys, old wineskins torn and mended, old patched sandals on their feet, and old garments for themselves, and all the bread of their provisions were dry and moldy, and they went to Joshua.
All right, stop right there. So what are they doing? These men of Gibeon come to Joshua, and what is 4 and 5 all about? Worn out wineskins, mended, worn out patched sandals on their feet. What are they showing to Joshua?
They
Like they're travelers, right? They look like everything was once fresh and new, and it's all worn out. Their bread is crusty, their wineskins are patched. So they're trying to say to Joshua, we're from a really far off land. Okay, why would that be important? What's that? Yeah, right? If they're in that land, God says, do not make a covenant with any of these people, right? Don't marry their daughters, don't worship their gods, don't make covenants with them. So if they're outside the land, man, that's fine. Okay, they're pagan peoples, but you can interact with them, no big deal. So they come to Joshua verse 6 at Gilgal, and they say, we're from a far off country. Now therefore make a covenant with us. What is the idea? What are they asking for? Peace. Okay, so let's make a covenant together. Let's not do battle. The men of Israel said, hey, maybe, perhaps, you're living within the land. How are we to make a covenant with you, or how do we know that we can't? So they have an idea, a suspicion, that this could be a trap, but they say to Joshua in verse 8, watch what they play to in Joshua. This is fascinating. We are your servants, verse 8. Joshua says to them, who are you and where do you come from? Verse 9, we are your servants. We've come from a very far country because of the fame of the Lord your God. For we have heard the report of him and all that he did in Egypt, all that the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, Sihon and Og, all that you did to them. Our elders said to us in verse 11, take provisions from your hand, go to them, tell them we're your servants and make a covenant with us. Hey, verse 12, our bread used to be warm, now it's crusty and nasty. Verse 13, our wineskins used to be filled with wine, now they're empty and worn out. We've been on a very long journey. Verse 14, the men of Israel took some of their provisions and did not ask for the counsel of the Lord. Verse 15, Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them. Let them live. Their leaders and the congregation swore an oath to them. So what do they placate to in Joshua? Okay. They know he's going to be a man of his word. What causes Joshua to go, okay, yep, you guys are indeed from a far off country. I can make a covenant with you. His what? The supplies were part of it, but he saw the supplies initially and said, you still could be a far off place, right? You still could, how do we know for sure? And then they go into another dialogue. We've seen your victories. We've heard about your God. Now, who's in charge of these victories? Or number two, if you will. Joshua, right? So what are they placating to in Joshua? His pride, his youth, right? And he hears that. And it sounds good. I mean, it is. It's a confession of, wow, your God's big. It sounds like Rahab all over again. Wow, we've heard about Sihon and Og and these big battles. And God, you've done all this. And Joshua, aren't you great as the leader of these people? Joshua doesn't stop and doesn't pray. You see some tendencies that Joshua has? Battle one with Ai. Send a couple spies. It's all good. We'll see how this turns out. You know, we don't need to send a bunch of men. Just a couple, 2,000, it'll be plenty. And what happens? They get spanked, right? Not good. And here again, you don't see him stop. You don't see him pray. He's got a suspicion. He's got like a, there's something in him that goes, this isn't right. But he looks with his eyes and goes, well, yeah, okay, you must be. So he makes a covenant with him. Now, what's the problem with what Joshua has done in verse 15? Doesn't seek God's counsel, and he makes a covenant. Can he undo that? No, he's given his word that these people will be protected by Joshua. So once he's given that, he can't undo that, and that's significant. Now, this is going to come back to bite Joshua in the rear end in a significant way. And it's not just going to be let these people exist, let them alone and don't kill them, you know, draw a circle around them and say, you're in the safe zone. Okay, that's not ultimately what Joshua is going to be called to do with these folks. But he does have a brilliant plan. And he's about to catch wind of the fact that these guys deceived him. Verse 16, at the end of 3 days, he finds out, oh, dang it, you guys actually were my neighbors. You live just miles from here, and you lied to me. They were in, verse 17, the cities of Gibeon, Cherepeth, and Kiriat Yearim. Kiriat Yearim is one of the cities we go to when we're in Israel. It's right next to Jerusalem. So they're in kind of this area. I'd show you on my handy-dandy map. I can see it. It looks great. None of you can. So, sorry. I don't know what's going on. Sons of Israel did not strike them down, verse 18, because God says, no. Okay, you can't do that. Verse 21, let them live was the command. But here's what they do with them. Look at verse 21 and notice where they put them.
And the ruler said to them, let them live, let them be woodcutters, water carriers for the congregation. And the rulers had promised them.
Okay, so they put them as woodcutters. for the whole congregation. Verse 23, now therefore you are cursed. You shall never cease being slaves, both hewers of wood and drawers of water for the house of my God. So where does he make the Gibeonites serve? In the tabernacle, right? What's Joshua's plan? I can't kill you, so I'm going to do what? I'm going to convert you. I'm going to make you hang out around the things of God all day long. And you're going to see Israel worship our God. You're going to cut the wood for the altar. You're going to bring the water in. You're going to serve the priests, right? That's going to be your job. So it's kind of brilliant, if you will. That was Joshua's ultimate deal with them. So he's going to put them into forced labor. He's going to at least have them help, if you will, and then expose them to the worship of their God day in and day out. Okay. Now, chapter 10, the rest of the kings in the south, by the way, and this is what I wanted to show you guys and talk through. You notice how Israel, when they came in just north of the sea, of the Dead Sea, right? They basically split the land in half, and they're going to do battle with all the people in the south, okay? And then they're going to turn north and do battle with the rest of the land up north. That's chapter 11, okay? But chapter 9 and 10 is the battles that happen in the south. Why is that a good strategy? Why not just come in from the Negev, from Kadesh Barnea, and come up to through the south and just do battle that way? Why would you split the land in half? Perfect. So they could go warn the other people. What else could happen? If you come in from the south, what can the people of the north do? They can come down and help the people of the south and do battle. So now you have to face everybody all at once. What's Joshua's plan? I'm going to cut off your supply lines. I'm going to take the roads. I'm going to take the high points of the geographical boundaries in the land, and I'm going to secure those so I can do battle in sections. And I'm going to go town by town and do battle in the south. And once we've secured those places, then we will turn our attention to the north, but we fortify the places that we need to fortify so that the north is not a threat to us right now. Does that make sense? Israel is very geographically divided just because of topography. We talked about that before. Joshua is brilliant in the way that he executes this. So coming in from the south would have been a disaster. Cutting it right through the middle is exactly how God wanted them to do that. Now, chapter 10, the rest of the kings in the south find out about what Gibeon, their ally, has done. And they're ticked that Gibeon had the audacity to make a covenant with Joshua. So now they're going to switch teams. And they're going to say, oh yeah? You want to make a covenant with Joshua? We're going to come spank you. So there's five kings in verse 1 and following that are going to gang up on Gibeon, who yesterday was their ally, today now is their enemy. Okay, 10 verse 1, Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, leads this kind of battle, if you will. And he grabs in verse 3, Hormah, king of Hebron, Purim, king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish in verse 3, and Eglon, and he says in verse 4, come up to me, help me, and let us attack Gibeon, for he has made peace with Joshua and the sons of Israel, right? So they see him, Gibeon, and the king of Gibeon as a traitor, as a defector, and they say, because of that, now we're going to do battle against you, okay? Now, verse 6, Gibeon finds out, oh boy, here are five of yesterday our friends, today our enemies, coming at us to do battle. They clearly understand what's happening. Verse 6, this is now their word to Joshua.
The men of Gibeon said to Joshua, the prophet of Gilgal, saying, do not relax your hand from your servants. Come up to us quickly and save us and help us from all the kings of the Amorites who dwell in the hill country are gathered against us.
What? What are they asking for? They're asking for help. Oh, we're sitting ducks. You know, we're all going to die. And who do they cry out to? Joshua. Like, are you kidding me? If you're Joshua, what are you thinking about right now? Oh, serves you right, you dirty dogs, right? You lied to me. You told me that you were foreigners. You're not foreigners. I made a covenant with you. I can't undo it. I can't kill you. But who can? Those kings can kill you. I got no problem with that. That's not how Joshua responds. Look at verse 7.
So Joshua went up from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, and all the mighty men of Baalah. And the Lord said to Joshua, do not fear them, for I have given them into your hands. Not a man of them shall stand before you. So Joshua came upon them suddenly, having marched up all night from Gilgal.
All right, so Gilgal is their home base, right over by Jericho. They march 18 miles all night long. It's a 3,500 foot ascent to where they are. So think about walking from here to Shaver to go do a battle. All night long, and in the morning, you've got a fight. How you feeling after that walk up the four lanes? You're a little tired, and who are you fighting for, right? Your brethren, your brothers, Israelites? No, you're fighting for a bunch of dirty, rotten scoundrels that lied to you like last week, and now they've got a fight. How serious does God take this covenant that Joshua makes? Man, you're going to honor it. You made peace with them, you're going to keep your word, and you are going to go defend the Gibeonites. And that's exactly what God does. They march all night long. Watch, when we talked about this yesterday about, Stephen, I think you asked the question about, we see at times God show up and do battle, and he intervenes directly, the angel of the Lord, and sometimes it's indirect. Look at verse 10 and who shows up. Azekah is one of the gateway cities we talked about a long time ago, one of the strategic cities that bordered Jerusalem to the west. So the Lord confounded them, confuses them, and he slew them with a great slaughter. Okay, it looks like he's not, this is like an indirect intervention. He's causing confusion, and they are slaying themselves, these five pagan kings from Yarmuth and Jerusalem, and these kings that assembled against Gideon. Or Gibeah, rather, now come together, and they start slaying themselves. So the first part of verse 11, that's what happens. Israel then chases them and pushes them back into these other cities. And then at the rest of verse 11, look what else God brings. Verse 10. No, you read verse 10. Verse 11. So what comes now? Fiery fastballs from heaven. Like, this is what God brings to deal with these people. So this is direct intervention, right? And more people die as a result of the hailstones, it says at the end of verse 11, than those who were killed by the sword. So God he's fighting again for the sons of Gibeon, these people that had lied to Joshua, but yet Joshua is defending them because he has given his word and God promises to protect them. So you see these crazy juxtaposition chapters, if you will, in one where you see God executing very firm judgment on a group of people, these pagan people, and in the very next chapter, God now defends them based on the word of Joshua. So you see this idea of this two-sided coin of God. He is wrathful, yet he is loving, and he will keep his word, and he does do justice here above and beyond what you and I think we would do, right? Most of us would sit back and say, man, let that battle unfold. My enemies are fighting my enemies. That's great for me, right? I'm going to get some bonbons and sit on my lazy boy and watch this thing go down. This is great entertainment. Joshua says, no, we're going to go in and fight. And not just a little bit, but boy, he makes it hard on his people. And it gets better, by the way. 12, keep going. Elon, I think is the, yeah.
Elon.
Yep.
And the sun stood still and the moon stopped until the nation took vengeance on their enemies.
What? So Joshua prays, like, hey, we need a long day to finish this battle. So, O sun, stand still at Gibeon, Joshua prays. O moon in the valley of Elon. Verse 13, so the sun stood still and the moon stopped until the nation avenged themselves of their enemies. What? What does that mean?
Daylight savings time.
Maybe, right? We don't know. There's several conjectures, but it seems like end of verse 13, the sun stopped in the middle of the sky and did not hasten to go down for about a whole day. Verse 14, there was no day like that before it or after it, and the Lord listened to the voice of man, for the Lord fought for Israel. No idea cosmologically what happened right there. Joshua got some extra daylight to do battle, okay? Now, you figure that out. Ask God when you get to heaven. But the text says that literally the sun stands still so that Joshua can finish the battle before nightfall. Crazy, okay? So, and again, this isn't even for his people. This is for the
Gibeonites that have lied down to Joshua, and he shows up and saves these kings. Verse 15, Joshua and all of Israel returned to the camp at Gilgal. These five kings had fled and hid themselves in the cave of Makkedah. So this is an area up in the hill country of Israel where there's tons of caves. They go into cave for protection. Joshua says, that's going to be your tomb. Verse 18, he rolls a large stone against the mouth of the cave and lets the men kind of sit in there and think about what they have done. He's going to let them out here in a bit. And he basically says, because of your actions, God has not delivered you, and you have fallen into ultimately our hands. In verse 20, it came about when Joshua and the sons of Israel had finished slaying them with a great slaughter until they were destroyed. The survivors who remained in the cities had entered the fortified cities. He deals with that. Brings in verse 22 all these kings out from the cave that they had hidden in. And then Joshua does something symbolic here in verse 24. Read that. What's that symbol? How do you put your foot on the neck of somebody?
Down.
You have to lay down prostrate before you, right? They're bowing before Joshua, and he puts his feet on their necks in order to show, we have won the day, okay? Verse 26, Joshua struck them, put them to death, hanged them in trees, just like he did with the king of Ai, until evening, brings them down, but he's making a display of God has won the day, and you are going to submit, because God will indeed win the battle, okay? So he wins the day, verse 28, he strikes it with the Makkedah with the edge of the sword, just as we've seen with Ai. He utterly destroyed it, every person who was in it. He left no survivor, verse 28. Thus he did the king of Makkedah, just as he had done to the king of Jericho. He wins this whole region and hangs the kings, wins the day. You see cities mentioned in here that are significant. The Lord gave Lachish into the hands of Israel, verse 33. Gezer came up and Joshua defeats him. These are, again, significant cities in the south that are gateway cities to Jerusalem, ultimately in the future. They are, they're giant landmarks, right? If you're going to go defeat Fresno, it's like Modesto, Madera, Fresno, Bakersfield. You're taking out the significant outpost on the way to LA, right? So if you win those cities, you've won the region. And that's what Joshua's doing. He's taking out the big cities and the big kings, okay? So he wins these battles, I should say. Verse 40, you get a summary now of all these battles that Joshua has fought in the south. Read that. All right, so you see some geographic places mentioned here. Joshua struck the land, the hill country. Okay, that would have been the Judah Mountains that we've talked about that kind of rise up in the area of Jerusalem. The Negev, which is where? The desert, which is down south, right? Kadesh Barnea was kind of the bottom of that. They came up. That is where the wilderness of Zin is, the Negev. The lowland, in Hebrew, that's the word Shephelah. Okay, that's the foothills, if you will, just like Fresno. It looks the same. So these are from west to east. You've got the coastal plains, the Shephelah, the Judah Mountains, and then kind of the Rift Valley or that area of the Jordan River Valley. They're describing all these areas that God basically has given victory to Joshua in their land. So they take all of it. Here's some cities that you mentioned. Some of them will sound familiar today. 41, Joshua struck them as far as Kadesh Barnea, which was the town where the spies spied out from. Even as far as Gaza, okay, so the Gaza Strip that we still hear talked about today, on the coast, on the Mediterranean Sea, in the southwestern portion of Israel, that is Gaza, to Goshen, to far as Gibeon, all the lands in the south, verse 43, Joshua and Israel with him gathered at camp at Gilgal. So they have now defeated the entire southern coalition of kings. All those kings that assembled to battle against Gibeon are now defeated. Joshua returns to home base at Gibeon, and now they're going to turn their attention in chapter 11 to the northern conquest and defeat the northern section of the land, okay? So that's the picture there. You with me so far? Okay. Chapter 11, verse 1. Let's pick up there, and let's see how now these northern kings are going to handle this battle.
When Jabin, king of Hazor, heard of this, sent to Jobab, king of Madon, and to the king of Shimron, and to the king of Akshath, and to the kings who were in the northern hill country.
Okay, so I won't make you read all those. He sends out word to all the northern kings. What is he doing? He's calling them together, saying, look, if we try to fight this battle individually, like some of these Ai and Jericho had, it's not going to go well. We need to have one fight. And we're all going to meet together. Verse 4, they came out, they and all their armies with them, and they meet, verse 7, by the waters of Mermon. This would have been northwest of the Sea of Galilee. Okay, so they meet way the heck up there. So all these peoples come from the north and from the south, and they meet together just northwest of the Sea of Galilee. And that's where their battle is going to be fought. And it's the king here in verse 11, Jabin, king of Hazor, that's leading this charge. Hazor was a city that Solomon one day is going to fortify. He's going to put a bunch of his chariots there. It's called a chariot city today. It is the largest tell in Israel. A tell is a flat plain of land. When you built up layers after layer after layer of civilization, you have these basically man-made mountains or foothills, if you will, when civilizations continue to build on top of civilization. Hazor was a gigantic one. It was 200 acres. So as you think about the size of things, that's a very, very large city. Okay, so this guy is the chief dog in the north, and he rallies everybody else to come fight. And all these men with their armies now come to meet. Okay, verse 7, it says, they were suddenly attacked at the waters of Merman and attacked them. So God, for the first time in verse 7, God is now on the offensive. Okay, he is going to attack them, unlike before when they were attacked. God now leads the charge. Verse 8, watch how this battle unfolds.
And the Lord gave them into the hand of Israel, who struck them and chased them as far as Great Sidon and Mizrephoth Maim.
I'm killing you with all these names.
And eastward as far as the valley of Mizpah. And they struck them until he left none remaining.
All right, so they do battle and they win the day. Verse 9, Joshua did to them as the Lord had told him. He hamstrung their horses and burn their chariots with fire. Why would God have them? It is sad. I saw the sad face. Hamstring their horses. What does hamstring a horse mean, by the way? Cut the hamstring. Or it could also mean to make incapable of reproduction. Okay. Either way, it's not a pretty picture. Okay. Does God hate horses? I don't think that's the case. What is God saying? Why would he have Israel hamstring their horses and burn their chariots with fire? Exactly. What did he say to the king of Israel in Deuteronomy 17? What could you not multiply for yourself? Women, money, and horses. Horses were what you would put your pride in, your strength in battle. Okay, these people had iron chariots. The Philistines, the people on the coast of Israel, were famous for their iron-working abilities. Their warfare was far beyond them. The temptation as the king would have been to have taken all their stuff and put now pride and significance in horses and chariots and say, that's what won the day. And God says, you're going to use none of that. I won the day. Burn it all. Okay? So horses are allowed to live, but they ultimately are not going to do battle. They're not going to reproduce. And they are not going to be the source of Israel's strength. And I think that's where God is going with that. Okay? So again, we see a great battle. We see utter destruction in 11. Hazor, he burns with fire. That's the other city that's the exception. Sorry, I mentioned that one earlier. So the other cities that they have taken at this point, they have not burned with fire. Ai, you see it with Jericho. Now you see it again with Hazor. They destroy ultimately in the city, everything in the city. Okay. Verse 13, however, Israel did not burn any cities that stood on their mounds except Hazor alone, which Joshua burned. 14, all the spoil of these cities, all the cattle the sons of Israel took as their plunder, but they struck every man with the edge of the sword until they destroyed them, and no one who was left breathed, in verse 14. So they're allowed to now, again, continue to take the spoil of victory. There was one city where God says don't. It's Ai. Okay, so out of 31 battles, God says the first one you're going to tie to me, and from there moving forward, you may not. Okay, so there's the entire battle of the Northern Coalition. That's it. Okay. All these kings assemble together, thinking they're going to have the upper hand. God attacks them first, mano a mano, if you will, And they go down. God wins the day. They take their cities, take their spoil. Now, Israel has essentially conquered the main portion of the land. Okay, the coastal regions to the west are still unconquered. There's still work left to do. But the battle has now tipped in favor of Israel. They've got numbers and they've got momentum. And they have control of the land, but not 100% of the land at this point. Does that make sense? So there's still work left to be done in order to go clear out your tribal allotment that God has given you. It's not done for you, but Israel has won the day. And now they're kind of putting out brush fires and skirmishes. Okay, the battle, the war, in a sense, is over. Okay, so that's the picture here. Okay, 16 and following of chapter 11, we get a conquest or a summary of the conquest. Excuse me, of the land. Okay, verse 18. Notice this doesn't all happen overnight. Read that.
Joshua made war a long time with those kings. There was not a city that made peace with the children of Israel except the Hivites, the inhabitants of Gibeon. All the others they took in battle.
Okay, so 18. It says a long time, 7 years. This entire conquest takes, okay? So south to north, the whole battles that they, the conquest, if you will, takes 7 years for Joshua to clear out this portion of the land, okay? They didn't make peace, just as God had said, don't make covenants except for the Gibeonites, and that's the idea. 21, Joshua came at that time and cut off the Anakim from the hill country, pushes them back to the south. The Anakim, again, were the giants of the land who lived in Gaza and the other coastal cities, Gath, where Goliath, we're going to find out his people live. There was no Anakim 22 left in the land in Israel, only in Gaza, Gath, and Ashdod where some remain. Okay, so they are still there, and the tribes that get allotments of land on the coast are now going to have to go do battle with the big, strong, tough guys. Okay, so they don't get a freebie, if you will. They've got to go fight. All right? Make sense? 12 is a continued summary of the land. All the kings that Joshua has to go up to and defeat. Look at verse 7. These are the kings of the land whom Joshua and the sons of Israel defeated. You get an entire list here of every king in every city. The summary of that is in verse 24. The king of Tirzah, one. Okay, one king there. In all, 31 kings. Okay, so 31 different, not battles, I should say, but 31 different cities and kings that they have to conquer to take this portion of the land. Okay, so they've got, at this point, control of the land. So, 1 through 5, preparation for battle. 6 through 12 now, the battles are over, and we really get, in a sense, just two chapters on the battle. One in the south and one in the north, and kind of an in-between deal with the Gibeonites. And then in 13 through in following, we're going to get like half of the book of Joshua on the conquest of the land. You see in like God's economy, what's most important to him, right? If this was an American movie, like where would the bulk of the action in the timeline of the movie be placed? Battle and special effects, right? And God's like, no, these battles happen. It's not something he chooses to glorify. What's most important to him is this is my land. And now we're going to divvy it out. And all the way through chapter 21, God is going to now divvy out the land, and then we're going to have Joshua's last hurrah, if you will. Okay? So let's kind of move through here. I want to show you guys how God is going to now divvy up the land. Okay? They have won the battles. They've done their job up to this point. They still have to be obedient. They still have to move forward. There's still, again, brush fires that they have to put out, but God is now going to let them go. Okay? 13 verse 1. Let's pick up there.
Joshua was old and advanced in years, and the Lord said to him, "You are old and advanced in years."
It's always funny to me. I feel like I've heard that. Oh, wait, I did just then. Okay, Joshua is somewhere between 90 and 100 years old at this point, which is crazy. He's been leading. He's the leader of the battles, right? He's the general, and he's 90 to 100 years old. Okay, this is the land that remains in all the regions, verse 2. The Philistines, the lands of the Girgashites, these are the people that they have pushed to the coast but need ultimately to get evacuated, if you will. Okay, God says, hey, I know they're there. However, verse 6, Will, pick up there.
All the inhabitants of the mountains of Lebanon, as far as the brook of Mirashphath and the Sidonians, the men, them, I will drive them out for the children of Israel. Only decided by lot of Israel as the inheritance that as I have commanded you.
So what is God saying about the rest of the peoples in the land?
I'll take care of
I'll take care of them. Okay. Now you've got to respond in obedience. I will drive them out, but you've got to go fight. And if you don't do your part, then I'm not going to do mine. Okay. So we're going to see this as a continual issue as we move forward with the conquering of the land. Okay. Now, verse 8, we're going to start with the land Transjordan. On the east side of the Jordan, who were the three tribes that settled over there? Reuben, Gad, half of Manasseh. Okay, Manasseh gets some sweet land, and they get it on both sides of the Jordan. I don't know how they pulled that off. Okay, brilliant. But they got land on both sides. Okay, with the other half tribe, the Reubenites, the Gadites, receive their inheritance, so they are given their land on the half side of Manasseh. The sons of Israel, however, in verse 13, did not dispossess the Girgashites, the Maacathites, or however you pronounce them, for Geshur and Maacah live in Israel until this day. So what are you beginning to see signs of within Israel?
Disobedience.
Partial disobedience, right? Not driving the people out. Now, those people are like, okay, we lose. You're good. Okay, can we just live here? And Israel's like, I've already defeated them. Why do we need to kick them out, right? They're bowing down to us. We've won the battle. So yeah, let them stay. That's fine. We'll live here or there or wherever. Okay, so that's the temptation now with this allotment of tribes and not wanting to clear out the land. Okay, and if you've done battle for 7 years, you think you're done doing battle? Like, you think you're tired and like, can we just be done? And I think that's part of the attitude behind Israel. They just want to go live in peace. They want to go sit in a home, right, and enjoy a house for the first time in 40 years and not live in a tent or what have you. Okay. So Gadites are given their land, 24, to the tribe of Gad he gave, to the sons of Gad, their inheritance and their following. So you see kind of what's listed there. Verse 29, Moses also gave an inheritance to the half-tribe of Manasseh, so they are given their land. And in 33, you see mentioned, the tribe of Levi, Moses did not give an inheritance to, for the Lord, the God of Israel, is their inheritance, and he had promised to them. So they will get cities, as we've talked about, within Israel, Levi will, but not land, okay? So they're going to live everywhere, okay? Now, 14, here is the formal division of the land. Watch who's in charge of this. 14:1, let's pick up there.
These are the areas which the children of Israel inherited in the land of Canaan, which Eleazar the priest, Joshua the son of Nun, and the heads of the fathers of the tribes of the children of Israel distributed as an inheritance to them.
Okay, so who's in charge here divvying out the land? Eleazar and Joshua. Who's Eleazar? Where's his lineage? Who's his pops?
Aaron.
Okay, that's Aaron's son. Okay, the third-born son of Aaron, the high priest at the time, and Joshua, who we know. And how do they give out the land, verse 2?
Their inheritance was by lot, as the Lord had commanded commanded by the hand of Moses for the nine tribes and the half-tribe.
Okay, so is this like the Oklahoma land rush? Boomer Sooner. No, like, you're going to live there. This is your land. You may go there now. Okay, this is your land. This is the area that God has given you through Moses. And Joshua is just divvying it out, giving it each to their portion. Okay, verse 6, notice who he starts with. What tribe goes first?
Judah.
Okay, you guys see your chapter heading up there. Hopefully you got one. Judah goes first. Caleb is from Judah. He is the first person that gets his inheritance on the west side of the Jordan, okay? Caleb, obviously, the spy that goes out with Joshua, he's one of the few from the previous generation that gets to come into the land. We're going to find out in verse 10, the guy's 85 years old, and he still wants to go fight. This guy's awesome. So, verse 6, Judah drew near to Joshua in Gilgal. Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, said to him, "You know the word of the Lord who spoke to me, Moses, the man of God, concerning you and me and Kadesh Barnea." He talks about their history with Joshua. In verse 10, he says, "Now behold, the Lord has set me to live just as he spoke these 45 years since he'd been in the desert." Now he says at the end of verse 10, "I'm 85 years old. Verse 12, "Give me this hill country about which the Lord spoke on that day. You heard on that day there were Anakim, great fortified cities. Perhaps the Lord will be with me, and I shall drive them out as the Lord has spoken." So what is he asking Joshua for? Give me the land that Moses said I can have, and what's the condition presently of the land? Who's in it? Anakim. He's like, bring it. I am not scared. Perhaps God will be with me. Like, this guy who's 85 years old has seen God's faithfulness. You see his heart. And Joshua says, go for it, buddy. So he's a neat dude. He's going to conquer his land. He's going to push out the people. He's going to go do battle. 15:1, the sons of Judah now take their stuff. They got Caleb as their leader. Take their land. And in 15 and following, in chapter 15, you can see the battles that they fight. Look at verse 13 of chapter 15. He gave Caleb the portion, Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the portion among the sons of Judah. So Caleb gets his land first. He gets the area of Hebron. Kiryat Arba is what it's also called. Hebron today is a Palestinian-occupied city. A ton of tension in that land, but that is where Caleb ultimately gets. It's north of Jerusalem. Verse 14, notice how Caleb finishes. All right, so what do you notice? What's Caleb do?
Drives him out.
Complete obedience with a very difficult foe. He drives out the remaining giants of the land. He continues to do battle. He promises anybody that will continue to clear out land on his behalf. In verse 16, his daughter Aksah says, you can have her as a wife. This dude named Othniel, the son of Kenaz, the brother of Caleb, captures it and now takes Aksah, his daughter, for his wife. So he is continuing to roll through. In the rest of chapter 15 are all the cities that we see now conquered by Caleb and Judah and in that land. Okay, Judah again is in the south. They get the desert area of the land. Simeon is going to be inside of Judah. Okay, it's a desert dwelling land. The northern portion of it borders Jerusalem. So the city of Jerusalem is actually in Benjamin, but Benjamin and Judah will kind of border each other. So, but the vast majority of their land, though it's a lot, is desert. Okay, it's like living in the Mojave. So, but he ain't scared. He takes it. Okay, he kicks out everybody and defeats the land. Okay, now 16 and following, you're gonna see the tribes mentioned. Ephraim goes next in 16. 17. Now the half tribe of Manasseh. Okay, the daughters of Zelophehad. You guys remember them at the end of the book of Numbers, who said, hey, our pops died in the wilderness, ain't got no sons, can we have some land? And Moses said, absolutely you can. God says, go for it. They're mentioned now specifically in verse 3, the daughters Mahala, Noah, Hogla, Milcah, and Tirzah. Verse 4, so according to the command of the Lord, he gave them an inheritance among their father's brothers. Verse 6, because the daughters of Manasseh received inheritance among his sons. So these women promised land, get their land, they take it, and they continue to drive out the inhabitants of the land. Okay, verse 13 of chapter 17. It came about when the sons of Israel became strong, they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but they did not drive them out completely. This is the theme and the problem with success, right? They see the remaining inhabitants of the land is not a threat, right? We've subdued them. They've submitted to us. How about we get like someone to make dinner and do the laundry, right? And rub my feet. Yeah, that's better. Why would we drive them out? We got now forced labor. Let's do that. So when they became strong, that's what they did. And that is ultimately going to be their problem. Years down the road now, they're going to continue to intermingle with them. They're going to intermarry their daughters. They're going to begin to worship their gods. And then all is going to go awry within Israel because of this issue of partial obedience. Okay, so this is ultimately the problem. Okay, so that's the issue. Watch in verse 14, sons of Joshua now, or Joseph rather, come now to Joshua with an issue. They say, why have you given me, in verse 14, only one lot and one portion for my inheritance? And I am too numerous of a people of the Lord. Like they're saying, hey, just like Reuben and Gad, we didn't get enough land. We want more. So verse 15, watch Joshua's response.
So Joshua answered them, if you are a great people, then go up into the forest country and clear a place for yourself there in the land of the Perizzites, the giants, since the mountains of Ephraim are too confined for you.
So he says, man, if you're as bad as you say you are and you're as big as you say you are, go clear some more land and take it. That's fine, right? Sons of Joseph said, the hill country is not enough for us. All the Canaanites who live in the land have chariots of iron. Those who are in Beth Shean, which was a significant city in Israel, and the towns of those who are in the valley of Jezreel. So, like, they're saying, we can't do it. We want more, but we can't do it. They're kind of crying a little bit, and Joshua's not having it. He's like, man, you're going to go clear it. This is a great response. Okay, watch Joshua's response as a leader. They're kind of crying like, oh, it's going to be so hard and so difficult. There's big, strong, tough guys in the land. We can't possibly. Watch what Joshua says to them in 17 and 18.
Joshua spoke to the house of Joseph, to Ephraim and Manasseh, saying, you are great people and have great power. You shall not only have one lot, but the mountain country shall be yours. Although it is wooded, you shall cut it down, and to the furthest extent shall be yours. For you shall drive out the Canaanites, though they have iron chariots and are strong.
So what do you notice in Joshua's response? How does he handle their kind of whining? Yeah, he encourages them. You're going to do it. You are a strong people. You guys are bad. Go get them, right? It's the coach in the locker room, right? He's rallying them and says, you can do it. So Joshua's a great leader. Man, I like this guy. And he's encouraging the people, has them go fight battles, okay? 18:1, I want you to notice something. Pick up there and let's see where the tabernacle ends up. Now, Shiloh would have been a natural kind of spot in between the north and the south. It was a convenient meeting place, if you will. And what do they set up there? The tabernacle, this thing that they've been carrying now for 40 years in the wilderness, and it goes to Shiloh or Shiloh, okay? It's going to be there for a long time, okay? So just remember, this is where it's at currently, and they're all kind of assembled together. They're in their holy huddle, right? All the tribes are assembled together in Shiloh. They've been given their land. And Joshua says to them in verse 3, how long will you put off entering to take possession of the land which the Lord your God, your fathers, has given to you? What is Joshua saying? Breaks over. Yeah, it breaks over, right? Smoke breaks over. Okay, it's been fun. It's been real. You got your 15 minutes. Go do battle. Quit sitting in your holy huddle and go do battle. How long are you going to put off your obedience? Go finish the clearing of the land. And he continues to push them and admonish them to go do the job that God has called them to do. So again, the rest of the chapters that we're going to see up through chapter 22 are more of the same of God admonishing his people to go do battle, Joshua specifically doing that, and pushing his people to obedience. Okay, so all the tribes are kind of getting there. As you can see, your chapter headings and the land that they got. It's going to show you an awesome map today of all the land so you can see them. I'll show them to you when we get into Deuteronomy. Okay. Notice, by the way, who gets his city last. There's a time as a leader to go first, and there's a time as a leader to go last. Okay, Joshua exalts who and lets his land get be the first person to get the land? Caleb. Okay, 49 of chapter 1949. Notice who gets his land last.
Timnah,
yep.
Timnah Sehar in the mountains of Ephraim, and he built a city and dwelt in it.
All right, now Ephraim, who Joshua is from, has already been given their land, but Joshua intentionally waits. Why would he wait as a leader to take his last?
Make sure his people have what they
need. Absolutely. Does that tell you about how Joshua cares for his people? How would it look if he would have went first or second? Very self-serving, right? Very like me first mentality. Joshua says, no, Caleb goes first. We'll honor him. I will take my land last to make sure the people get what they need. He was going to get his regardless, right? It's not like someone's going to take his land, but he goes last, which I love about Joshua, okay? 20 and following now, you see the cities of refuge. Remember, we talked about six cities on each side of the Jordan that were given to the Levites, three on each side. What were the cities of refuge again? What purpose did they serve? Yeah, so if you accidentally killed somebody, second-degree murder, not first-degree, you were able to flee to that city until the death of the high priest, and you were free. As long as you didn't leave the city, you could not have vengeance acted upon you, if you will. Okay, chapter 21, these are all of the 48 Levitical cities. Okay, we're obviously not going to read all of those, but these are the cities all across the land that the Levites are given to live in. House arrest? No, it's like, hey, you're going to go live within the confines of the city. Don't leave the city. And if you leave the city, you're free game. So no, you were a free person. So you had all the rights of an Israelite. You weren't locked up, but you just could not leave the city. So it was a really big house arrest, I guess is probably the best way to look at it. Okay, so that's kind of how they appropriated it. Okay, so all of chapter 21, the rest of the dividing of the land, the Levitical cities that are given last now. Okay, chapter 22 through the following, we're going to see kind of Joshua's kind of farewell speeches, if you will, and kind of the issues of the 2.5 tribes on the other side of the Jordan. Okay, there's a preview of what's about to come in the book of Judges with now the dividing of the land. Okay, the Jordan River served as a very natural boundary between the west and the east, right? And to this day kind of still does. Not as significant as it was back then because of the size of the river, but there's an issue that's about to occur because of this natural boundary, okay? Joshua says to the Reubenites, the Gadites, in verse 1, hey, you have kept in verse 2 all the commands that you said you would to Moses, right? You promised to come fight. You have fought. Verse 4, therefore turn now, go to your tents, go home. You've done your job. You've kept your word. You brought your 40,000 men. You have fought faithfully. Verse 5, only be careful to observe the commandments, right? Don't forget about us, your brothers on the other side of the Jordan. Walk with God, keep his commandments, serve him in verse 5. Joshua blessed them in verse 6 and says, now go home, okay? Verse 9, the sons of Reuben, the sons of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh returned home, departed from the sons of Israel at Shiloh. Verse 10, they come into this very large place that God has given them. And in verse 12... is it there? Where is the verse 12? Watch what happens. I'm sorry, verse 10. Here it's mentioned. Sons of Reuben, sons of Gad, and the half tribe of Manasseh built an altar by the Jordan River, a large altar in appearance. So on their way home, before they kind of cross over the Jordan, or after they cross over it, what do they build? Altar. And what do altars generally mean? It's like a symbol of God's faithfulness, right? It's a remembering deal. And that's what they say. Behold, the sons of Reuben, verse 12, half tribe of Manasseh built an altar to the Jordan on the side belonging to the sons of Israel. When the sons of Israel, verse 12, heard of it, the whole congregation of the sons of Israel gathered themselves at Shiloh to go to war against them. So you've got 9.5 tribes that are about to go to war with 2.5 tribes. How did they interpret said altar that these guys had built? What do they think that it is? Is it an altar to honor God? No. So what else could it be interpreted as? You just built an altar to honor other gods. Maybe it's to Baal or Asherah or Molech or Chemosh or something. So they get flaming hot mad. Okay. Verse 13, read that. That's not the guy's name you want to have read, right? Phinehas. We remember our boy Phinehas, Numbers 25, who likes to carry a spear and shish kebab people. Phinehas. Okay, so he's coming into battle. He's mad. He comes in verse 16 and says, hey, what the heck? What is this unfaithful act which you have committed against the God of Israel? By turning away from following the Lord this day, by building yourselves an altar to rebel against the Lord this day, is it not the iniquity of Peor? He's saying, isn't this just like what we did in Numbers? When everybody died, there was this huge plague, and we were rebelling against God. The rest of Israel sees this act as a pagan altar to rebel against God. And the sons of Manasseh and Gad and Reuben are like, whoa, 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 whoa. This is not at all what we'd intended. Like, y'all are wigging out. Like, relax. Take a breath. You know, and Phinehas goes on this rampage in 17 and following, talking about what happens when they're disobedient. I mean, this guy's got, like, holy, righteous flames in his eyes. He's like, man, we're not doing this again. 20, he mentions Achan, who acted unfaithfully, and he's walking through the history of what happens when people turn against God, okay? In verse 23 now, or 21, the Reubenites are given a chance to speak, okay? They say in verse 22, the mighty one, God, the Lord God, he knows why we built this. If this is an act of rebellion in 22, or if it was an act of unfaithfulness. He's like, so we see how obviously you interpret how we built this, okay? In verse 23, if we have built an altar to turn away from following the Lord, or if we had built an offering of a grain offering on it, or if offering sacrifices or peace offerings on it, the Lord himself will require it. God knows our heart. 24, but truly, we have done this out of concern for a reason, saying, in time, your sons may say, what have you to do with the Lord, the God of Israel? Why would that be a concern for the 3.5 tribes living on the other side of the Jordan? What do we have to do with the God of Israel? What are they saying? Yeah, like they live over there. We live over here. What do we have to do with them? Why do we even worship their God? So they're saying, hey, no, we are them. We are they. We're all one. We just live on opposite sides of the Jordan. So they said, you know what? Let's build an altar so that we can remember the commitment that we've made to serve that God. And just because we've got the Jordan River in verse 25 between us, we're still one people. Therefore, that's what they did in verse 26. We built this altar that it would be in verse 27, a witness between you and us. Okay? Verse 28, not for burnt offering or sacrifice, rather it is a witness between us and you. We're not planning on offering sacrifices on it and working outside of the Levitical system. It's just a memorial, Phineas. Put down your spear. We're okay, right? Verse 30, Phineas is like, okay. This is what he says.
Now, when Phineas the priest and the ruler of the congregation, the heads of the divisions of Israel who were with him, heard the words of the children of Reuben and the children of Gad and the children of Manasseh spoke, it pleased them. And Phineas the son of Eleazar the priest said to the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and the children of Manasseh, this day we perceive that the Lord is among you because you have not committed a treachery against the Lord. Now you have delivered the children of Israel out of the land of the Lord, out of the land of the Lord. And Phineas said, Phineas the son of Eleazar the priest, and
all right, you can stop there. So you get the idea. What does Phineas do?
Puts his spear down.
He listens and he puts his spear down. Right. So it's he's a guy that's been, God's holiness is a big deal to him, but he listens and goes, okay, I see your heart. I completely misunderstood that. And he's a wise enough leader to listen and go, that's on me. My fault. I misinterpreted that. I get it. We're good. Thank you, guys. So they leave good. Okay. They say this is a witness between us, between you and I and our tribes, that we are all on the same team. Okay. So that ends well. But what are you seeing now is part of the problem initially with these tribes being on different sides of the Jordan River? There's division. They're cut off, right? So culture, language, dialect, right? It's a pain across that river. So you're automatically creating separation. And in Judges, we're going to see that heightened. And it's not going to be a, oh, no, you just have misinterpreted what we meant by that. It's like, oh, no, we know exactly what you meant by that because that's what you meant by that. And we are not on the same team. And we're going to see a civil war within Israel occur of brethren fighting brethren because of partially this issue along with idol worship and other things. Okay, verse 1 of chapter 23 came about after many days that the Lord had given rest to Israel from all their enemies on every side. Joshua was old, advanced in years. It's the first time we've seen this in a long time where they have rest from their enemies. Verse 3, Joshua says, you have seen all that the Lord your God has done to all these nations, how he's been faithful to us. Verse 6, he reminds the people, be firm, keep and do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses. Let's continue to obey. Let's continue to be obedient because that is the key to victory. In order that, verse 7, you do not associate with these nations that remain among you or mention the name of their gods. Okay, that is not what we're going to do. Or make anyone swear by them, serve them, bow down to them. You are to cling, in verse 8, to the Lord your God alone. Okay, so Joshua is given his last hurrah speech, verse 10. The Lord your God is he who fights for you, just as he has promised. He's reminding them to be faithful, and he's reminding them the battle is not over. Okay, we've got to continue to fight, drive out the people from the land. Less in verse 18, the Lord your God will not continue to drive out these nations from before you. They will become a snare and a trap to you. What is Joshua already recognizing as the tendency of the people now that they have rest and the hard battle is over? They get comfortable to put their feet up on the lazy boy and say, man, all's good. We're going to be fine. There are slaves. Nothing bad can happen. And Joshua's saying, you are deceiving yourselves. You have no idea the trouble that you're about to get yourself in by doing that. So he continues as a good leader to rally the people and push them ultimately to complete and utter obedience, if you will. Okay. Now, chapter 24, Joshua gets all the tribes together at Shechem, okay? And now he's going to give his official kind of last hurrah. He rolls through the history, again, as every great leader has done. Starts with Abraham's dad in verse 2, Terah, beyond the river, talks about Abraham, the land. Verse 4, Isaac and Jacob and Esau and God's blessing on all of them. Walks through, again, this Israelite history all the way up to where they are at now, and reminds them in verse 12 and following, okay, what God has done in clearing out the land. And then he says, here's how God has helped us. Look at verse 12, someone pick up there. God says, I sent the hornet before you, right? I was in battle, in a sense, with you to drive out Sihon and Og, the two kings of the Amorites, in verse 12. Keep rolling there in 14.
Now, therefore, fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in faithfulness. Put away the gods that your father served beyond the river and in Egypt and serve the Lord.
That word, serve him sincerely, literally means complete. Like, all of you, complete obedience. You see what Joshua is continuing to push for? They've done 90% of what God's called them to do, but what is Joshua worried about? Man, it's that last 10% that's going to bite you in the butt if you don't do it. Serve him with all of you, right? Don't bow down to their gods. Don't fail to drive out everybody. Do it, okay? And then Joshua says in verse 15, just in case there's confusion about what y'all want to do, here's what I'm going to do. This is a great, you guys have heard this verse probably 1,000 times, but 15, Joshua draws a line in the sand and says, who's on my side? How about that? You don't want to serve God? Great, don't. You want to serve the gods of Moab? You want to serve the gods of our other people on the other side of the Jordan River? Chemosh, Molech, knock yourselves out. You want to serve Baal and Asherah, the gods on this side of the river? Knock yourself out. There's no in-between, though. As for me and my house, we're going to serve God. So if it's disagreeable for you, fine. But don't try to serve God and these other gods. It's one or it's the other. Choose this day who you are going to serve. And Joshua draws a line in the sand and says, I'm on this side. God's getting all of me. So, God, this guy's great, right? Not just because of his military prowess and ability to lead, but you see the heart of Joshua is, man, I'm going to serve God completely. And that's what we see with this guy, okay? They say in response in verse 16, far be it from us that we should forsake the Lord to serve other gods. We're going to serve this God. God did this for us. He brought us out of the house of bondage in verse 17. In Egypt, he's taken care of us. Verse 18, the Lord drove out from us all these peoples, the Amorites. We also will serve the Lord our God, right? This is a great Sunday morning speech from the people. They're emotionally charged. They want to do this. The problem is Monday morning's coming, and it's going to get difficult. And that religious high that they're on is going to go away, and it's going to get hard and unpleasant and difficult and long and burdensome. And they just say, man, enough. It would be so much easier just to hang out with the Canaanites, right, and intermingle with them. And that's the problem that Joshua knows is coming, and that's why he continues to push on them to say, man, we need complete obedience, okay? In 23, he even reminds them, even at this time, look at what is present.
Now, therefore, go on.
23. So what are we already seeing in the midst of the people? What have they already done with some of the battles? They've already taken some idols. They're already commingling, right? They've already, in these 7 years, plus the time it's taken to clear out some additional land, they're already picking up habits from the culture. Joshua says, get rid of them. In 25, Joshua made a covenant with the people that day and made them a statute and an ordinance at Shechem. So get rid of this stuff, okay? So these are his last words, if you will. Joshua commanding the people to be obedient, okay? And he reminds them that this is going to be a memorial. Verse 27, this stone here at Shechem shall be for us a witness, for it has been heard all the words of the Lord which we have spoke. Thus it shall be a witness against you, so that you do not deny the Lord your God, or the your God. So that is Joshua's kind of final speech to the people, and he's pushing, again, obedience. Okay, 29 and following now, the death of Joshua. Pick up there in 29.
Now it came to pass after these things that Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died, being 110 years old, and they buried him within the border of his inheritance at Timnath, which is in the mountains of Ephraim on the north side of Mount Gash. Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had known all the works of the Lord which he had done for Israel.
All right, stop there. So Joshua dies. They serve him during the time that Joshua lives. Joshua always gets a bad rap, right? Because after him is judges. But what does it look like? Joshua is raised up after he dies. Who's leading? Elders. We've got godly men that are leading Israel. And Israel continues to walk with God until these men die. So where ultimately is the failure? It's with the elders, or Joshua not communicating to the elders, hey, it's great that you're godly, but if you don't raise up the next generation and instill godliness in them, we're going to end up in the book of Judges, right? So Joshua had done his part, but remember, it's not just about the generation behind you or even the generation after that, right? Moses says in Deuteronomy 6, right, that it's the children's job to raise up godliness, or the parents' job to raise up godliness in that generation and the generation to follow. Paul says in 2 Timothy 2:2, the things that you have heard from me, Timothy, in the presence of many witnesses, entrust these things to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. Paul, Timothy, faithful men, teach others also. Paul's saying, look, my legacy is built four generations away from me, and I will know if I have done my job if my spiritual great-grandkids are doing their job. That is a legacy, okay? So this is where it fails. And guys, this is our job, right? I'm looking at my kids right now and thinking I'm trying to instill godliness in them, but I'm not trying to raise, is it a mule? Mules, right? What's the problem with the mule? What is it a mix between, by the way? A donkey and a horse, right? What's the problem with the mule? Mules can't make other mules, right? I don't want to make... They're great, they're valuable, and they're helpful, but they can't make more mules. I'm trying to raise kids that understand the value of reproduction. If they don't get that they have got to pour their lives into their kids and onwards, then I failed at doing my job as a parent. It's not enough for me just to instill godliness in them. I have to instill the godliness, the burden of discipleship into them, onward into their families. Does that make sense? And that's where somewhere the ball gets dropped, whether it's Joshua, whether it's the elders. But somebody drops the ball, and that's why we're going to get into the book of Judges, and it is going to go bad in a hurry, okay? Because there is no sense of godliness. There's rest, there's peace, and prosperity, again, is going to bring about difficulty, okay? So there you go, gang. We are like a month ahead in residency. I think we should just take like a month off. We'll see you guys in February, okay? All right. You guys have a great Christmas break. Bless you. We'll pick up Josh or Judges when we get back. Have a Merry Christmas. Spend a good time with family. Bless you guys. Be safe and be merry.